From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 7th day of February, 2020. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's at globalanalytics.biz out of Atchison, Kansas. We'll look forward into next week's World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate Report with him. We'll check out the weather forecast with Eric Snodgrass from Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible, and we'll hear from David Vetter, who highlighted this week's organic grain conference that took place at the iHotel, and it all happens on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report, production of Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
In Chicago, March corn for the day finished 4 1/4 cents higher at $3.83 1/2. The May at $3.88 1/2 up 4, and July at $3.92 1/4, 4 1/4 higher. December futures $3.94 up 4 1/4, and the March soybeans a penny higher at $8.82 a bushel. May $8.95 1/4 higher, July at $9.08 up 1/4, and the August unchanged. It finished at $9.12 1/2. Next year's November at $9.18 1/2, down a penny and a half. The bean oil futures 27 cents lower. At $30.97, the bean meal up $1.10 at $289.30 a ton. Wheat futures soft red July at $5.57 up 3 3/4 cents. The hard red July at $4.85 1/4, 3 3/4 higher. Live cattle futures in the April at $119.80, a nickel higher for the day. March feeders down 70 cents at $135.20. In February, lean hog 60 cents lower at $57.10. Crude oil 61 cents a barrel lower. Ethanol just about unchanged. Heating oil down 2 2/10 cents per gallon. That's diesel fuel. And the gasoline on the RBOB up 2.5 cents, $1.52 3/10 cents. That's the wholesale price. Natural gas at $1.85 3/10, down about 9 1/10 cents. The Dow Jones Industrial Average 264 points lower. The U.S. dollar is up 0.189, and the gold futures up $5.10. We're now joined by Mike Zuzulo at globalanalytics.biz out of Atchison, Kansas, to discuss the marketplace for the day. Good afternoon to you, Mike. Thanks for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Todd. Happy Friday to you and all the listeners.
Let's talk about that 4 cent jump in the corn. What happened there?
I think the corn market was probably the leader in making a distinction in the market between the cash price, the export demand, the difference between agriculture commodities and basic materials, industrial metals, and energy. In other words, I think early in the week, because of in part the Bloomberg story about the Chinese potentially wanting to refigure or delay some phase one trade deal numbers, that never materializing, and the Trump administration actually saying that they had not heard that, and also a couple reports of force majeure on copper out of Chile, and also LNG out of the South America and maybe even North America. I think the trade in general, Todd, I think got lumped together with the commodity markets, where energies and materials and agriculture were all together early in the week. But I think by Thursday and Friday, with the weekly export sales showing almost a 60% jump in the corn versus the four-week average, the basis at the Gulf hitting 70 cents a bushel again, that being the best basis since August. River basis in Memphis and Cincinnati back near or above $4, hitting levels not seen since late January. I think all these things, along with the spread, maybe gave the corn a chance to be the long side of the spread for a change instead of the short side.
Am I right that it hit some chart resistance on the top side?
Yes, I would call it minor chart resistance. I continue to feel like the 392, 395 level in lead month corn is going to be much, much more important than any other level below it, especially as we get closer and closer to the delivery time period for the March futures.
Do you think it can make it there?
I do. I think fundamentals are there. I mean, I know we're still behind in the marketing year when it comes to the 1920 marketing year for the exports year to date. But I think our livestock feeding, the Mexican purchases are really coming on strong. The physical product of corn continues to get smaller and smaller here in the United States because of the Northern Plains. And I would just continue to watch that March Dease corn spread, because at 9.5 cents today, at one point it was hitting the 2020 high. So I would look for that March Dease corn spread maybe to show the first potential for a break up of 392 to 395 on the flat price.
By the Northern Plains, you're talking about the standing corn. It's just getting a smaller crop every day that it stands in the cold and the wet and the snow.
Yeah, and I continue to hear about that every week. That's exactly right. Those five states that the USDA is supposed to resurvey, it is not getting better up there. It's getting worse. And, you know, it's going to become more of an issue as we get into the later part of February and early part of March, because I think many analysts, when they look at the 2020 acreage number that we're going to get a week from today by USDA with their first baseline projection, I think many of us will start to say, okay, that may be the number right now. But in 3 or 4 weeks, if Minnesota and the Dakotas still look cold going into mid-March, those numbers are going to change. They're going to drop when it comes to corn acres. And I think that needs to play itself out in the futures market at some point. I'm hoping that it happens before those basis contracts against the March come due.
Yeah, so those are something producers will be worried about. They're also thinking, hey, if he gets to that 390 area, can we get above that? What do you suppose?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, the thing that I saw this week, and I'm not trying to paint too rosy of a picture, because the worst thing could happen next week, other than a USDA report that blows us out of the water, is the coronavirus gets worse because more Chinese go back to work. And that's what's going to happen as far as the Chinese government's having more go back to work next week. But when I saw the Tyson CEO talking or listening to him on his communications on his earnings, and said that they're filling additional orders to China of pork, and that they've seen year-over-year increases of nearly 600% in the first quarter. And then I hear the Mexicans tell us that they're looking at a big jump in Chinese beef demand when we take about 80% of their beef exports. And then I hear that the Brazilians are also looking at a big jump in Chinese beef demand, mainly because of the coronavirus and trying to replenish stocks. I start to feel as though the trades got this all wrong. In other words, yeah, maybe copper they won't need as much, maybe crude oil they won't need as much, but food is a whole different situation. And I think that will play out within the next couple of weeks, and that'll answer whether we get that bump before those basis contracts come due.
We'll be watching that for sure. What else have you been paying attention to?
Well, again, going back to the early part of the week trade, I think the dollar was a big safe haven. It's at a four-month high as we closed out Friday. But at the same time, we started to see some fight back in the wheat. The hard red wheat was actually one of the biggest gainers on the week this week. And I think it's because we're getting drier and drier and drier in eastern Colorado. Clients in southwest Nebraska, western Kansas, starting to tell me that they're looking very dry, and the drought monitor showing that as well. So I think we're lining up again where the wheat's probably the next key to getting us off the launch pad again for that corn rally. So I think you need wheat at this point, and I felt like meal did what it needed to do this week. We talked about that last Friday about a potential buy signal. Looked like it gave that buy signal on a weekly close today.
Did you trade the Prius off, or do you have it ready to make the trip here to the Beef House for the March 3rd event?
I am excited. We have the Tesla station wagon ready to go. Its its windows are automatically out of it just because we got the five kids.
I thought maybe you'd have a Cybertruck by now.
No, we're still driving the Yukon from 2011, Todd. It's coming up on 100,000 miles.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to having you over here on March 3rd. And thanks so much for being with us today, Mike.
I'm excited. Thanks, Todd. See you.
Yeah, we'll see you soon. That's Mike Zuzulo. He's with GlobalAnalytics.biz out of Atchison, Kansas, and will be one of 16 analysts to join us up on the stage at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana, on the third day of March. It's not very far away. For the $30, you'll get all 16 of those analysts. Beef House roll and coffee in the morning. At the noon hour, you'll get the Beef House lunch. Can't beat it. Just get yourself registered today online. All the details are there at WILLAG.org. Well, this week, the Organic Grains Conference is taking place at the I Hotel here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. And David Vetter has come in from Nebraska. Some of you may have seen, or potentially will go hunting for, a movie that is out called Dreaming of a Vetter World. He's been involved in organic production in one way or another, I think, for, I don't know, three, four, how many decades has it been?
About 4.5, 45 years directly on our own farm operation. And then when I was a kid, because my dad was an organic farmer beginning in the early part of the 50s.
So you're from Nebraska. How did you come to this idea that maybe organic farming would be something you'd like to try or maybe go back to as a better view of it?
I guess for me it would be a go back to. My dad, following World War II, went to all of the short courses at the University of Nebraska. He's one of the first big promoters of using synthetics in agriculture in our county, on the county board, first commercial applicator of pesticides. And was a good observer, and he saw things beginning to happen in the environmental context of the farm that they promised him wouldn't happen with these materials, and decided that wasn't the right way to go and quit. Started farming organically in 1954.
And you followed through.
And, you know, I followed through because if I was going to farm the family farm, I didn't have a choice, number one, but I still would have gone that route just because of what I picked up at the university and in my soils classes and all of that kind of stuff. So it was just part of who I was. I was raised that way. That's what we did on the farm while I was growing up.
So these days I have a question because I have watched the movie. You're back, or were at the end of the movie at least, actually doing the work on the farm, but you have spent a very long time on the farm but doing a different business, and they appear to be two separate tracks, right?
They are two separate tracks. Early on, we found out we had people that wanted the organic grains we were producing beginning in 77, 78, but we had no way to get them cleaned or graded and in condition so that a manufacturer could use those in food processing. And so that spurred us to take the plunge and invest in building a facility to clean and condition grains for our customer base. And that's been a lot of my focus since that time. So we started that in 1980.
So you built a niche market for yourself.
Yeah. We had people asking for it, and we couldn't deliver it. So if we're going to make our small 280-acre farm make us a living, we had to have those high-value markets.
And so you're able to do that with the farm and the business now, and very well, if things are correct in the movie.
Yeah, and one thing led to another, and we added value-added processing besides whole grains, and the financing we needed to do that came from the farmers that we were helping market and from our customers. And so that was a win-win for all three of us in there for that, and we've continued to build on that. And now it's two totally separate businesses. So our farm deals with the food processing company like we deal with other farmers.
Yeah. So 280 acres on the home farm, you've got the business. How many acres do you represent in total?
Oh, how many acres in total? I have no idea. We've worked with farmers from California to Ohio, Michigan, to southern Texas, to central Saskatchewan, and Alberta. I don't know how many acres that
Did it bug you when I said a niche market?
No, because in the beginning it was a niche market. It was very much a niche market. Not so much anymore, but because we're a small operation and focused, we have a lot of competition we can't compete with just because of our scale. So we're always on the lookout for niche markets. And the high-value niche markets for which it's really difficult for other companies to compete with you are the ones that we like.
So you look for places where you can put products that most people won't even bother with.
That's correct. Or processes that people don't want to deal with because they're hard and complicated. For example, we make a full line of diets for companion birds that are certified organic.
Right. So you've got a niche market within a niche market. A niche market within a niche market.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Right. So those are the kinds of things that we like because they're, you know, everybody depends on each other in that process. And so you've got to figure out a way to make it work for everybody in that supply chain.
That's one item. Figure out how to make it work for everybody. Locating the somebody has to be difficult.
Finding those niches are difficult, but I guess one of the advantages we had, we were probably the first there with our processing facilities because nobody else was doing one that was made specifically for organic product. And so a lot of our really niche market customers came to us looking for something to have somebody do something that everybody else had told them couldn't be done.
Some of this can be regional. Are there businesses like yours or somewhat like yours across the country that you look out at and say, oh, I like what they do?
There are some businesses that do some niche things, maybe not as much very specific or as narrow as what we do, but there are a number working locally with maybe crop varieties that were traditional in those communities historically and coming back and working with farmers to grow those and moving them into the food supply chain, but mostly in local regions, not national.
Here at this Organic Grains Conference this year, and I've been to different conferences over the last three decades, it's the first time that I recognized commercial farmers that I see at events consistently at this Organic Grains Conference. What do you tell those who are interested in this area about getting into this area? And what's your message for them this week?
My message is there's lots of opportunity. We're importing a lot to fill the demand. Prices, when you've got a special supply chain that you need, sometimes the shortage of that limits the ability of the industry to grow. And so in those cycles, sometimes the prices are down a little bit from what traditional premiums might be. But as the supply increases, the manufacturers, processors, feeders, whatever niche you're in the food supply chain on the organic side, are under a lot of pressure from their customers or the consumer to do it locally. And so if they don't have to rely on imports to make sure there is a consistent supply, they're going to move the other direction because it's to their market advantage in the end.
And finally, what's the hardest thing on the actual farm production side?
The hardest part on the farm production side in making the conversion, it's the part between the ears. It's how you think about and make decisions.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time with me today.
Thank you.
David Vetter is from Nebraska and is highlighting the Organic Grains Conference here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. If you'd like to search online for Dreaming of a Vetter World, I know that you can find it and watch it. On this Friday, Eric Snodgrass is here to take a look at the weather forecast. He's with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. Hey, Eric, great Friday afternoon to you. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, it is. It's a good Friday. That's right.
All right, so let's go through this weather pattern that we've been in. There's been rainfall and snow, ice. I know that January was really pretty wet for Illinois. I think there's just an awful lot of moisture across the whole of the United States, depending on where you are, truly. But that could become problematic. What do you think?
Well, the problems, I think, are just the fact that when we look across almost the entirety of the Mississippi watershed, and I'm including in here the Missouri and the Ohio River valleys, we've just got a lot of surplus water in the soil. So some places in the Dakotas, it's up to 6 inches. You know, around the state of Illinois, it's generally about 2 to 3 inches. Southern Illinois has been much, much wetter in the northern half. And even though January came in wet, it was wet with liquid, not with snow. We didn't really have too much in the way of snow during the month due to the warm bias that we've had. And so what we've got ourselves into is a position that should we not break down this weather pattern, we're kind of just getting ourselves set up to maybe have some problems for the early planting season if, and that's a big if it continues to stay wet.
How about in the southeast?
Well, in the southeast, the problem has been that the last week has absolutely soaked parts of the Tennessee Valley, parts of the Ohio River Valley, going all the way down into like Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. And I'm talking, they just got in the last 7 days, some locations 3 to 8 inches of rainfall. Now, the jet stream is currently set up exactly as it was set up last spring. What I mean by that is it's split in the Gulf of Alaska. So there's a branch that goes north toward Alaska, southern branch that cuts down just south and east of Hawaii, and it all comes back together in Texas. And if that happens, that just makes the jet stream race from Texas to Maine. And we sit right underneath it. So does the Ohio Valley. And we get system after system after system coming through. And each one of these systems seems to leave like a lingering frontal boundary just had drake there across like Tennessee and parts of the Southeast. Now they want to be getting a crop in the ground pretty soon here. I mean, they start talking about doing this. They're planting at the end of February and beginning of March, especially, you know, you get down to Texas and down to the Gulf Coast. And I've just got them so wet through the next at least month that I think it's going to be a challenge for them to get much done. So this pattern keeps everybody wet if you're in the Mississippi watershed and in the Ohio Valley, Tennessee Valley as we move forward.
Does California stay wet or are they dry based off of this?
Yeah, so the last 30, 40 days, California has been dealing with this split flow. So all the excess precipitation run through Washington and Oregon. It's coming to the northern Rockies, and much of the Intermountain West is just piled up with snow right now. List reporting stations are at least 100% of normal, if not well above that. But California is not. Sierra Nevada got about 60% of normal snowfall right now. And the concern is over the next month, we're not seeing too much in the way of breaking that pattern down to bring them the snow they're going to need. So we need to keep an eye on it, just because if the West Coast starts off dry like this, it could mean a lot for California ag. And don't forget, they lead the country in the production of over 40 different fruits and vegetables. So that change tends to hit us at the grocery store rather than in our commodity prices.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of changes in South America, are there any changes in their patterns?
Yeah, well, this is what's getting tricky. Usually at this time of year, we tend to watch the Magellan Oscillation and whatever phase it's in South American precip. But the MJO, combined with the fact there's no real strong El Nino signature, means that predicting the weather in South America right now beyond about 7 to 10 days is just, you kind of feel like you're getting into no man's land. So what we see right now is where they're trying to harvest soybeans in Mato Grosso, Goiás, Tocantins. You know, this would be the northern and eastern growing regions, which get planted first. The rains that are there over the next 7 days could be more than normal, and as a result, maybe slow it down a little farther. And if we do slow them down, that could impact the pace at which we plant this Safrina corn. And we know that they're going after big acres on the Safrina corn just due to domestic supply issues. Argentina, though, they got, we call it a $1 billion rain. They had the rain come through right at the critical time for their crops. So South America right now not presenting major problems that I think might affect the markets if weather's going to do that. But we need to keep an eye on them as we switch to the Safrina crop.
Hey, one last thing I want to keep an eye on, which is the number of people that have pre-registered for the All Day Ag Outlook. I've been watching that. Looks like things are coming along nicely. And you will be over there with us on the third day of March at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Up front, I want to thank you for doing that. I appreciate that much. And I'm looking forward to hearing you talk about the weather and what conditions are like for the United States and corn and soybean farmers in the Midwest.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun, and we're going to go ahead and put our binoculars on and look out as far as we can just to see what might be of concern as we plow through this 2020 growing season.
Oh, that should be fun. Hey, thanks so much. We'll see you on that third day of March. We'll talk to you, of course, before then here on the Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Medium. Just a quick reminder, if you'd like to pick up tickets for the All Day Ag Outlook, that's easy enough to do. It's just $30 online at WILLAG.org. You'll find all the details there. Don't forget that Commodity Week will air on many of these radio stations over the weekend, and is up online right now at that same website, or you can find it as a podcast in Stitcher, SoundCloud, NPR One, Spotify, Apple Store, the Google Play Store, however you'd like to listen to it. Great program this week with Bill Biederman, Dan Zwicker, and Aaron Curtis. Commodity Week is our weekly look at what's happened in the world of agriculture. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.